Live.
Welcome to the Church of Mavis Radio Show. Friday night, you're listening to United Public Radio 107.7 FM. And let me see, I have one thing to plug here, and then we'll get started with our guest. We got Wham here with us tonight.
Hi, Wham.
Remember, we're on FM radio.
Beer and pizza. Beer and pizza.
I forgot to say before we started, remember we're on FM radio, everybody. Please,
yes,
no
yes.
cursing.
Yes, no bad words.
All right. That's for me, too, everybody. All right. The thing I have to plug, International UFO Congress Conference and Film Festival, February 15th through the 19th. That's in 2017. 26th Annual International UFO Congress. You can go to UFOCongress.com or call 1-877-836-0110 and check out the tickets or if you're interested. They also have great DVD sets. I can't remember their names right now, but I found some pretty unique Native American like little seminars from this place, and Ozark too, who I plugged before in the past. Well, let me see. Really quick, I just want to mention the guests that are coming up just for the rest of this month. Let me find it. August 19th, Brennan Store. We'll be discussing paranormal subjects. Another author from Lillewin. August 26th, Rich Newman. Also paranormal, I believe, Bridges, and he's from Lillewin as well. And then, of course, September, Ben Mesrick. He's got a book, UFO Highway. I haven't got the book yet, but a new book. He's a pretty big author, so enjoy that. September 9th, Jamie Davis Whitmer, like Haunted Hotels. September 16th, Michael Davis from the Lovecraft E-Zine. We're going to be discussing some hardcore H.P. Lovecraft and horror fiction from authors who write Lovecraft-type stories and all that. September 23rd, Christopher Garantano, Montauk Chronicles. September 30th, Graham Phillips, The King Arthur Show, Live from Britain. Wham's going to be there for that one.
Yeah.
The first King Arthur show. It's not easy finding a King Arthur guest.
No, well, I'll have to rewatch Excalibur just to get in the mood.
Yeah, that's my favorite, definite favorite, no doubt about it. Just quickly for October, Greg Kaminsky, Ronnie Thomas, that's that weird Frankenstein dude kept his wife's body in a house or something bizarre, like some modern day weird Frankenstein story. Saul Luckman, that's about DNA and kind of self-help type stuff, some therapy before Halloween. August 28th for our Halloween show, Nick Redfern. Boom.
Yeah.
So there you have it. That's the lineup. Been working hard on making an eccentric, unique lineup, and I think I've done it. Hold up. Let me see. Closing all these windows and stuff. Tonight's guest, Ken Gerhard, The Return of Ken, A Menagerie of Mysterious Beasts, Encounters with Cryptic Creatures. How you doing, Ken?
Good evening, guys. I'm doing wonderful. Thanks for having me on once again. It's been a while, I know, but it's truly an honor and a pleasure to be here, always.
Last time we had you on, I believe it was when your Winged Humanoids came out. That was last year, right? Yeah.
That was about 2013, so it's probably been about 3 years, yeah.
I lose track. Good to have
you. It ain't hard to do, man. It ain't hard to do.
So first off, how's Bozo Porno Circus doing? Is that still going? Are y'all still touring with that and everything, doing that?
Oh, man, we did one gig, I guess it was last December here in town. And other than that, things have been pretty quiet, man. have a lot going on, obviously. So do many of the members in that band. Everyone's in multiple projects, and actually, we're all pretty spread out right now throughout Texas. I have members in San Antonio, Houston, Austin, Dallas, and it's just so hard to get everybody together on the same page. So it's unfortunately it's on the back burner for now.
So just to get this out of the way, because I've been wondering, I saw Missing in Alaska, and I really liked it a whole lot, but they're not going to be doing any more of them at all?
What I'm hearing, Jeffrey, is that there's been a change of regime at the History Channel at the top levels, and they're looking to mold the network into their vision. You know, people always want to kind of put their stamp on things. So we're in limbo, but it's not looking good because it's been kind of a long break that we've been on here, so... it's unfortunate. I had a great time making the show, wonderful people to work with, and there were a lot of mysteries still to explore up in Alaska, but such is the nature of the television business.
I enjoyed it. It was definitely, to most any other shows in that genre, it was very unique, the subject matter, and I appreciate that for sure. Are they ever going to put it out on DVD or anything?
I don't know. I haven't heard that, but I would hope so. I mean, it seems like, you know, what's cool now is that we're actually getting a lot of syndication in foreign countries. So I'm getting a lot of feedback right now from England, Italy, France, South America, and even like in Asia, Indonesia and Philippines. So, you know, I'll open up my Facebook and I've got 10 friend requests from Indonesia, and I'm like, okay, something's going on here. So. So that's cool. That's cool. It's kind of playing around the world, and hopefully some DVDs will come out at some point.
Yeah, because I was looking for it, and I think it's like on Amazon. You can just watch it, but I don't think they don't have a DVD.
Mm-mm.
Yeah, you can like watch it on there, but you can't buy the DVD. So
I never actually even got DVDs. So. You know, and not to sound spiteful, but I've done a lot of television shows, and typically they give you a courtesy DVD just for your own collection or whatever, but no, I never got one from the folks in Missing Alaska.
It is on Amazon. Watch it like on their Prime thing or something, somehow, like you just watch it on like Netflix or whatever.
Yeah.
So tell us about a menagerie of mysterious beasts. What got you starting on the sojourn of creating this book?
Well, the book is a sort of a compilation of different investigations I've done over the years, a huge diversity of subject matter. You know, a lot of people are familiar, of course, with Bigfoot, Sasquatch. It's a pretty hot-button topic, even things like the Loch Ness Monster, the Chupacabra, and so forth. But there are a number of mystery creatures, or cryptids as we call them in the field, that are reported from all over the place, and a lot of those don't get a lot of exposure. So one of the benefits to being on television is people do get in touch with me that have claimed to have seen remarkable things, and sometimes I can tell they're maybe making up stories or things to get, you know, to kind of get attention, but sometimes you know, I'll interview people over a course of months and get to know them, and I find them, you know, to be credible, and their stories are often very compelling. So there's about 50 or 60 never-before-published first-hand accounts in the book that cover everything from Bigfoot-type hominids to werewolves and black panthers, sea monsters, thunderbirds, living dinosaur, reptile-type things like pterodactyls, even some giant amphibians and invertebrates, you know, things like giant insects, bugs, and in the very last chapter, I even kind of flirt with some metaphysical things. So I covered some things like the shadow people, the hat man is one that I cover, black-eyed kids, fairies and mermaids, things like that that are a little more whimsical in nature, just for fun. But it's been a book, I've been working on it for about 3 years now, ever since the Flying Humanoids book came out, so happy to see it finally coming to fruition.
So do you consider werewolves and dog men the same thing?
Yeah. We just had this discussion this past weekend, Jeffrey. We did we organized an event up in Defiance, Ohio called the Dogman Symposium. And actually it turned out really well. The Dogman Symposium.
Yeah.
And we had like 154 people show up from as far away as New York and other places, and you know, Linda Godfrey, of course, Stan Gordon, Nick Redfern, Lyle Blackburn.
Awesome.
David Weatherly, John Tenney, the usual suspects. And we all talked, you know, we discussed it at length, and I think the consensus is that dog man, essentially, when you break it down, The word "Ware," of course, is a German origin, and that means man. And then, you know, dog and wolf, I mean, genetically you're talking about two species that can interbreed, so they're very closely related. So, and physically they look very similar if you're talking about some of the husky-type dogs and things. So yeah, we're talking about modern reports of a werewolf, for lack of a better word, creature. Some people describe them as upright canids. Some people describe them as having more powerful, like human-like bodies with a wolf-like head. And it's a pretty hot topic right now, as you might imagine. If you go on social media, you'll see all kinds of dogman groups and discussion boards and podcasts popping up everywhere.
Yeah, well, we've had a few guests on about Dave Hawley. He told a story about seeing a dogman face-to-face. When it comes to their demeanor, are they always, like, pissed off? Is that pretty much, it seems like that's how they're being painted stereotypically, is like angry or threatful or threatening.
Yeah, well, you know, some of the iconic cases just off the top of my head, you know, eating roadkill, chasing people, chasing cars, scratching cars, chasing people through the woods. So yes, they do seem to have kind of a hostile nature. Now, that said, I don't think we were able to come up with an actual account that describes a physical attack by a dog man. There's a famous film known as the Gable film. I'm sure all of your listeners have heard this, but several years ago it was making the rounds on YouTube, and it was alleged to be some found footage from like the 1970s of some guy being attacked by this dog man creature in Michigan. But it subsequently it turned out that that was a hoax. So the guy came out and admitted he just basically fabricated the whole film just kind of for fun. So yeah, I mean, they are similar to the Mothman and flying humanoids, which I wrote about. You know, the fact that they are very aggressive towards people, and they seem to move at impossible speeds and defy physics, but yet they never catch anybody. Isn't that strange? They'll chase people, they'll chase you to the end of the earth, but they never want to physically contact any human.
I've heard they were enemies of Sasquatch. Is there any truth to that you know of offhand?
That I don't know. I mean, I'd be wildly speculating. It's interesting the overlap that you have in terms of the reports. You know, it seems like a lot of these dogman sightings come from areas where there are also Bigfoot sightings. So I would just be speculating as to whether or not they are somehow related or they're in conflict or whatever. But there are many people that think there is some type of connection. Not real sure.
So as far as like Dogman and Sasquatch and some of these cryptids, do you lean more towards them being completely physical, or do you believe that they're coming in and out of quantum realms, which is pretty much what I kind of lean to, because I've seen a lot of weird stuff myself, and I know for a fact there's quantum realms around us. So I'm just kind of curious what's your perception on that.
Yeah, of course I get asked that a lot, particularly in this day and age. There seems to be kind of a new spiritualist movement where people definitely are thinking in very cosmic terms, which is cool. But, you know, first of all cryptids, and I just mentioned this at the conference this last week, pretty much all cryptids, in my opinion, are cases of composite identity, meaning that you have a lot of different factors kind of involved. So, for example, and pick a cryptid, you can say, okay, a certain percentage are probably people making up stories, or, you know, perhaps they're delusional, or they just want attention, or they're hoaxing. And then you have a certain percentage of reports that are probably misidentifications of known animals, you know, a fleeting glimpse of a bear or something like that. And then you start getting into, you know, the actual, once you've eliminated all those, you can look at the other reports. And if you have a wide variation in physical description, that becomes problematic, right? Because typically when you're talking about a flesh and blood animal of any kind, there is a fairly consistent archetype or model as far as how they look. So in terms of cryptids that have appeared in the fossil history, like Bigfoot or Sasquatch, there were giants, robust prehumans, hominids for, you know, hundreds of thousands of years. In terms of thunderbirds and lake monsters and some of those, I think that they probably are flesh and blood viable species, something that are, you know, very rare. They're very elusive. They live in very remote areas, and therefore we don't see them very often. But in terms of things like the dogman, the mothman, goatman, mermaids, things that have these kind of impossible physical characteristics, you can't just combine human features and canid features. That's physically impossible. You know what I mean? It's, you're talking about things that are separated by tens of millions of years of evolution. So in those cases, and it bears out, because when you look at a lot of the reports of Dogman and Mothman and some of those other weird creatures, they seem to have more metaphysical, physical things attributed to them. They vanish into thin air. They're impervious to being shot with guns. Their eyes glow. There are weird orbs of light circling around them, things like that. So you hear that kind of stuff a lot in terms of kind of the really weird fringe cryptids. But, you know, Bigfoot, Sasquatch, Thunderbirds, lake monsters, I think all of those are viable flesh and blood creatures, species.
I'm kind of curious about dragons. You have a chapter, Modern Dragons.
Mm-hmm.
And I know there's dragon-type energies. I've had some experiences in my younger days with the shamanic type substances and had some weird serpentine type experiences to where, I mean, at one point it felt like there was a huge dragon and I was like in its hand. And of course I've seen some strange serpentine type beings in the past when I, in my early 20s, when I was dabbling with the occult heavily after my dad died and I was healed from cancer. Just had a lot of bad stuff happen, so I started seeking a lot and messing around with stuff kind of foolishly and had a lot of experiences. But I'm kind of curious about some of these modern dragon stories. What does that consist of?
Well, you know, as you mentioned, the dragon obviously has some spiritual significance to many people and many legends and mythologies around the world. Dragon is kind of an all-encompassing term, right? It describes a lot of different things. But in terms of my book, basically it refers to reptilian cryptids, which really run the gamut. For example, in the 20th century, there were reports from Europe of giant snakes, giant lizards, and reptiles in Italy, France, and other places, Switzerland. So you have these in Europe where you have these, this archetypical image of, you know, the dragon slayer and the dragon living in the cave and all that kind of stuff. You actually had some sightings or accounts by villagers of seeing giant reptiles, lizards, snakes. Those were never really explained. And then moving over to North America, it gets even weirder because you have, for example, I wrote about, something known as the Milton lizard, or the Kanab Creek lizard, which was reported in Kentucky, right in the Ohio River, back in 1975. And it was described by this giant lizard was living in a junkyard. And it was described as by the witnesses as being some 15 feet long, so way bigger than even a Komodo dragon, largest storm lizard. So it was kind of living in this junkyard, and it was occasionally seen kind of scurrying into the brush. And then probably the weirdest one, are known as the mountain boomers, river dinos, and in my book, I call them the Texas T-Rex. So there are reports of basically small, they're not really T-Rex in the traditional sense, they're not that big, but people in North America, believe it or not, have reported from time to time basically what can only be described as dinosaurs, bipedal reptiles standing about 5 feet tall with a long, sturdy tail, powerful rear limbs, small head on a long neck, and small, tiny arms. So very similar to many of the bird hip type dinosaurs, like Eurynthropod dinosaurs. And most of those reports come from Colorado, New Mexico, Texas. And so there's been a recent spate of sightings from South Texas. So, and of course, finally, the reports of living pterosaurs or pterodactyls. And as you know, Jeffrey, I've been collecting reports of those for many years now, and I've had a lot of people that have contacted me and swear that they've seen these flying reptiles, you know, which allegedly went extinct when the dinosaurs did 65 million years ago at the end of the Cretaceous. So the modern dragons chapter is not very, it's not really metaphysical in nature, it's just basically a lot of cryptid reptile type things.
Cool. All right, turn over to Wham for a while. How you doing, Wham?
Wham, how you doing? Just sitting here listening. And you have, you said you had a chapter on the more, I guess you would call them more humanoid cryptids. And you mentioned, did I hear you right? You mentioned, did you say men in the men in hats or the men in black?
Oh, no, I said at the end of my book, I have a chapter that's about some of the whimsical, not humanoid, but I do a section on the Hat Man. I don't know if you guys
are
familiar.
Okay, yeah, tell me, that's what I heard. What's the Hat Man? I've never heard that
one. The Hat Man is a shadow person that is often reported, similar to other shadow beings that are seen, you know, particularly late at night or early in the morning, as people come out of kind of a semi-conscious state or coming out of sleep. And they see this ominous figure standing at the foot of their bed or in the hallway. And like all shadow people, they describe it as basically just the blackest black, you know, lacking some form, but having enough form that they can tell what it is. But the interesting characteristic that people describe is that this being or this apparition wears a hat very similar to either a top hat or what they call an old pork pie hat, you know, like an old style hat. And this is very common. I had a young lady in San Antonio contact, and she didn't know where else to turn, and she had this encounter with this Hat Man figure when she was young, and according to her, there were other things that went on around their house, some occult activities and UFOs and different things, but she had this sighting of this Hat Man creature, and she was convinced that it actually happened, and at the time she saw this thing through her window, it was moving around in her yard. She was sharing her room at the time, I believe, with her aunt, and she tried to wake up her aunt, and her aunt seemed to be in some kind of strange coma-like state, like a trance, and wouldn't come out of it. So I did a blog for a while for the city of San Antonio, and for a paper here, and I put the Hat Man story up, and lo and behold, I was completely blown away by the number of comments and all the feedback that I heard of from other people who had also claimed to have seen this Hat Man creature. Apparition, and many of them lived in San Antonio or on the west side of San Antonio. So I don't have a solid explanation for it. The more pragmatic explanation when referring to things like shadow beings is that a lot of people do describe them while they're laying in bed, while they're kind of coming out of in and out of sleep. So I guess if you wanted to play devil's advocate, you'd say that people, you know, can often have very vivid hallucinations in that state, you know, and can see things maybe aren't there. But, you know, maybe there's more to it. You know, maybe these are thought forms or apparitions or manifestations that are connected to, as Jeffrey was saying, the quantum world.
Well, that's interesting. I mean, that struck me. The reason is because I've been compiling some family information myself for some writing that I'm doing. And I ran across an account that apparently I had taken maybe about 15 or 20 years ago from my grandmother, that I had just been hanging out with her one afternoon. She, you know, she was not real well towards the end of her life, and so sometimes, you know, various of the grandkids would go and hang out with her, you know. And so I decided this one day that I would try to get some old stories from her. And so I had asked her, because of my interest in the unusual stuff, I had asked her if there had ever been anything really weird that had happened when she and my grandfather were living on the farm that they remembered. And she had told a few stories, you know, all of which were interesting but not necessarily that remarkable, except for one story, which I had written down but completely forgotten about until I refound it. And this was like really only a couple weeks ago. And in this story, they had just moved into the last farm that they had owned. They had just moved in there. They had only been living there maybe 2 or 3 months. And it was early summer. And, of course, my grandfather had the habit of getting up early and going out and doing the chores, and then my grandmother would get up a little bit later, you know. And they were in a room that wasn't actually a bedroom. They had converted it into a bedroom. And she had the bedroom windows open. And the sun had come up, but there were curtains against, you know, curtains blocking the full sunlight, although they were like kind of a white curtains. And she sat up. She was awake. She had woken up. Nothing in particular had awakened her that she remembered. She woke up. She sat up, and she was getting up, and she heard a noise outside the window. And she thought it was, you know, Grandpa, you know, her husband standing there. And the light was coming in the window. The light was, you know, but she couldn't see because the, you know, the person clearly, because there was a, there were curtains there, and they were hanging limply because there wasn't any wind. And she said she very clearly saw a silhouette of someone standing there very close to the window that had some kind of, it looked like they had like a high peaked collar. You could see the silhouette, and one of these funny fedora hats, which was not the kind of hat my grandfather wore. And whoever it was standing right outside the window. And of course, it scared the crap out of her, you know, and because she thought it was an intruder or something. She didn't know what to do. And so she really quickly ran up the stairs to the second floor where you could look out of that window and see straight down to see who it was, you know. So she said it only took her like, you know, half a minute to run up the stairs. And and the lot that they were on, the yard that they were on, was a huge yard. It was, and it wasn't terribly planted at that time. When I knew it, it was all planted with gardens and, you know, and trees and everything. But this was before then. And so it was like 3 acres big. It was huge. It was a huge yard. And so she could have easily seen anybody walking away. So she ran up and looked down, and there was like nothing there, nobody there. Well, that really freaked her out. So she waited till Grandpa got home from his chores, and he came in, and she was all worried, and she told him about it, because then she thought, well, maybe it was just like an intruder trying to get in, you know. Mm-hmm. Well, what was really weird, and she said, what was really weird is what Grandpa found outside the window. They had just dug up garden beds right outside along that side of the house, and they were really deep garden beds. They were probably, you know, five to 7 feet wide. So if someone was standing right outside the window, they would have had to have walked over this freshly, you know, dug up earth. It was moist, but it was kind of powdery. And they found, you know, Grandpa went out there not expecting to find anything, you know. What they found was one footprint, one left footprint right outside the window. In order for somebody to have done that, they would have had to have leapt, landed on one foot, and then leapt off. And she said that scared her more than almost anything else, because they couldn't explain it at all. So she said it was a while before she slept with the window open again. And I had completely forgotten about that story. And I asked her if anything else odd had happened during that time period, you know, around the farm, because they were new on that farm. And so Grandpa had just gotten some new cows, new calves, you know, just to sort of begin the process of outfitting the farm. And she mentioned that, she said, you know, this is what Ira had written down. She mentioned that it was funny that I had asked her that, because it was during that same time period that there were two other odd things that had happened. And it was like all in the same three-week period. My grandfather had just gotten some new calves. They were relatively new calves, probably, no more than 2 or 3 months old. And he went out there one day, and three of them were dead, for no reason that they were ever able to determine. I mean, he went in and had a post-mortem done on them because he thought maybe they'd been sick, you know, and he needed to know whether they had anything communicable. And they apparently had, like, blood coming out of their mouths or something, but they were not killed by a predator, and they could never determine the cause of death. So obviously that upset him, because, you know, you don't want to lose that money. So that was just kind of a weird thing. And then my grandpa also had this shed where he kept all of his supplies and, you know, just junk that he would use to repair things with. And according to my grandmother, apparently over a period of several weeks, he would go in there, and, you know, he had his own way of organizing everything. He would go in there, and he would find that something had gone in there and completely reorganized it.
Hmm.
Like, night after night. Like, nothing was taken.
Right.
But it would be, like, completely reorganized, like, overnight. You know, something that would take hours to do. And of course, then he would have trouble finding stuff because somebody had reorganized it. And it got to the point where he actually called the sheriff at one point, but what could the sheriff really do because nothing was being taken? It was just weird. And finally, it just stopped. So all of that happened kind of at the same time.
That sounds like a fairy activity, right?
Yeah, it does. It's odd. It's weird. But anyway, the thing about the one footprint really freaked my grandmother out. It was like, she said it was like a left, it was like the left footprint, and it was very clear. It was like the type of footprint you get, like a dress shoe, you know?
Yeah. Wow, that's pretty creepy stuff.
Isn't that weird?
Yeah, I'm fascinated with all that stuff, and that's why I include some of it in the book. But admittedly, as a cryptozoologist, I don't even know how to begin in terms of investigation or anything like that. I mean, I love hearing the stories, and I find them fascinating. And obviously, a lot of people have had these types of experiences. But I guess it's a cop out. But as a cryptozoologist, I feel like that maybe I could find some physical evidence if I'm looking for Bigfoot or a Thunderbird or something.
Right.
And I really tip my hat to anyone in the paranormal field, and I have many friends that do that, because that is such a daunting task in terms of trying to. If that's your objective, I know a lot of people don't care about physically proving it. They just want kind of the validation. But for those that are out there trying to kind of prove that a lot of these metaphysical things are going on, it's there's definitely something to it, but you know, how are you going to prove it? It's very daunting.
Yeah, I guess the thing that struck me was that, you know, a lot of times with Bigfoot, you just find one footprint too. I mean, sometimes you find more. But sometimes, I mean, I've seen that. Sometimes you just find one. And in fact, there are Indian legends about that, about them,
yeah.
At least here in the Northeast, about how Bigfoot will only leave one. So I just thought
I've heard that, but you know, and admittedly, obviously you've seen that, but in the thousands of Bigfoot reports that I've studied throughout the course of my life, the percentage of reports that include aspects like that even are very, very, very low in terms of the percentage of the big picture. That's just my experience. And I know people use things like that to kind of jump to the paranormal aspect. So one of the things we're talking about Dogman this weekend, you know, getting back to the composite identity thing, could some of these cryptids could embody all of it? Could you, in fact, have a physical Bigfoot, Sasquatch, some type of great ape or hominid running around the woods, and then could you also have this metaphysical aspect where you have perhaps a related or unrelated phenomenon where creatures that look like Bigfoot are, you know, that are not totally physical, are manifesting, and could that account for some of these other stranger reports? You know, anything is possible.
Right. Well, I tend to think that if there are non-physical beings that are manifesting, when people see those, we are, you know, what they look like, whether it's Dogman or whatever, what they look like has more to do with us than it has to do with them. So
mm-hmm.
that if we see something that looks like an ape, or we see something that looks like a lizard or whatever, that has to do with our interpretation of how they're appearing to us.
I agree with you 100%.
That's how I've always kind of seen that. And the reason that I say that is because, I mean, most of my personal research and field work has been in UFO contact and abduction cases. And and I found out when I was doing my master's thesis on this topic, interestingly enough, I found out in going to like 20 zillion bazillion, it seemed, UFO and alien conferences in the 1990s, I found out really quickly that when you pay attention to the stories that people are telling about their experiences, their alien experiences, you know, in terms of, you know, people are really obsessed even now with trying to delineate all of the different races and species, you know, of aliens, that in fact, a lot of times, if you look really carefully at those descriptions are much more about our expectations of what aliens would look like, or if aliens look like this, then they're going to act like this, that kind
right.
of stuff. And in fact, I mean, that's in fact what I wrote my dissertation on, is actually analyzing that feature of alien abduction narratives. So, you know, if there is a metaphysical, if there are metaphysical beings that then we see a dogman or we see Bigfoot or whatever, that's probably not what they really look like, whatever that means.
Right.
That's what we're seeing of them.
Yeah, no, I think you, that's a wonderful point, and it is about interpretation. And again, at the Dogman Symposium this past weekend, you know, I think that was the consensus, is that these things are thought forms of some kind, and therefore they're related to us, as you said, kind of on an unconscious level. And so we see, you know, it's a form of energy or something that manifests, but, you know, we see essentially what we want to see, and we draw from our own experiences and maybe from the global experience, because we're perhaps all connected a little bit, and we're able to draw this imagery up. So I think some of the cryptid cases like Bigfoot, and we kind of took the long way around the bar there, but some of the cryptid accounts that feature really strange, you know, features and characteristics could definitely be something along those lines. You know, but that said, I still think there's enough evidence that there could be a flesh and blood undiscovered hominid running around in the remote wilderness areas. I think there's enough circumstantial evidence to, you know, to speculate about that as well.
Well, and I think the idea that it's not either or is important.
Hey, Ken, I just wanted to ask, did they record any of those seminars there that you recall? Or are they going to do that there, like put DVDs or anything of people talking at that symposium?
I recorded mine. I know David Weatherly, who did an excellent one on skinwalkers and shamanic practices and how those relate to the Dogman, videotaped his. I can't honestly say if anyone else did. I left that up to each individual speaker, since it's their intellectual property, whether they wanted to videotape their lecture and so forth.
I have to ask,
but,
Dave. I was thinking about Stan Gordon. I'd like to see Stan Gordon back there for sure.
Oh, he did a wonderful presentation on Pennsylvania. Really took us back, because Stan, as you know, has been investigating this stuff for half a century. So
yeah.
he was able to go back to kind of the weird 70s and talk about a lot of these hairy humanoid reports from Pennsylvania, and those are some of the weirdest quote-unquote Bigfoot reports that you have. I mean, a Sasquatch walking through the woods with a glowing orb in its hand, stuff like that, you know,
yeah.
It's like, where the heck did that come from, you know? So,
it'll rock your mind out with those some of those experiences from his books and everything. It's definitely UFOs and Bigfoot, and man, there's one I saw about some big weird alien slug or something.
Wow.
Yeah, I'd like to see. I don't know if he has any recorded seminars, but if y'all put those out, let me know on any level. I'd like to check those out for sure.
Yep, will do.
But let me see. Oh, I know what I wanted to ask. What about personal paranormal encounters? What are some of your top ones that you've had personally?
We're talking about paranormal, not cryptid-related?
Experiences are both. You can pull from both. So just anything that you've experienced, like the top ones.
Well, as far as people often always, of course, people always ask me if I've ever seen a cryptid with my own eyes. I never have seen one with my own eyes, so I can't say definitively that any of them exist. But I believe I've heard Bigfoot or Sasquatch vocalizations on at least two or three occasions. I didn't actually see what was making the sounds, but one case in particular, I was up in North Texas years ago with another researcher named Chester Moore Jr. from Texas, and we were investigating a pretty remote location where there had been sightings of something, and right after dark, we were hiking around this tiny lake, and suddenly we heard these noises, and I recorded them, in fact. I had a video camera going. It was kind of like a deep, best way to describe it is like a deep grunting, sort of a combination between a deep diabolical laugh and a panting and a coughing kind of sound, but just incredibly loud and powerful. I mean, it was literally shaking the brush. And there was a moment where we kind of all looked at each other and it was kind of like, I know we're on the radio here, so I won't, but you know, we were dropping a lot of expletives because it was like, what is that? You know, none of us, that is not anything that any of us have ever heard before. And we didn't actually see the thing because it was in this heavy brush. But a lot of other weird things happened that night. And then the culmination of that, the next morning, we finally did break our way through the brush to where this thing had been making these noises. There was a little beach along this lake. And on the beach, there were some very deep, though indistinct tracks, something very heavy. It had been walking through the mud, but you couldn't really make a lot of detail out. But what was really creepy is that there were several mutilated turtle shells. And I'm talking about the really big, like red-eared slider turtles that you see like in lakes and rivers. Imagine someone had grabbed one of those turtle shells and ripped it in half like a piece of paper, right down the, from side to side. And there was no flesh or any remains of the turtles, just these. It was almost like someone was cracking these giant turtle shells like pecans or something, or, you know, pistachios. I mean, it was like really weird. So that's the most convenient. That's the first time I ever thought, wow, there really is something to this. There is no animal, a human can't do that. There's no animal in North America that can rip a turtle shell in half. I don't know if that can happen anywhere in the world. It's not an alligator or anything like that, you know. I mean, these were cleanly ripped, torn. So as far as paranormal stuff, and as I said, I have an interest in that stuff, but obviously it's not my main focus. But I've been very fortunate to tag along, if you will, with other paranormal investigators, with an try to being objective and stuff. And I most memorable was with I was with Larry Flaxman at the old Prue House in Jefferson, Texas, and there was a ghost box session going on in the kitchen. And as he and I were standing in the hallway, this very heavy kitchen door, very old heavy kitchen door, just slammed shut right in behind us. And we spent quite a bit of time trying to debunk that and figure out if it was rigged or there was a breeze or anything. But I mean, this door just slammed shut and there was no breeze or no doors opening or anything. It was that was kind of cool. And I've taken part in some cool ghost box experiences with different investigators where we've interpreted hearing some pretty bizarre things, but you know, so I've been very like, oh, and I have had, and I don't want to be one of those guys that's like, oh, I've seen this, this, and this, but you know, I really have seen what I call a UFO. And what's crazy about that story is that this was actually on a Bigfoot investigation. So, you know, I've spent all this time kind of trying to poo-poo the connection between Bigfoot and UFOs. And lo and behold, I'm at this place in Ohio called Charles Mill Lake, which is near Mansfield in central Ohio. And me and this other guy are doing this nighttime investigation because there have been these Bigfoot sightings out there. And suddenly we see this giant black triangle, just like people describe, hovering, flying over our heads. It was pretty high up, but it was huge. And this thing had like multicolored lights that were flashing around the three points in the end. And it was completely silent. We had seen a bunch of airplanes fly overhead that night, so we were used to airplanes, you know, what they look like, the sound of the engines and stuff. But this was completely silent. It was massive. And I mean, I'm not saying it was extraterrestrial. Perhaps it was a military experimental military craft. I know there's a lot of Air Force bases in Ohio and stuff, but that was really freaky, seeing something like that. You know, you're out there looking for Bigfoot and you see something completely unrelated like that, and it's, you know, it's like, it's kind of completely out of context. So
makes you wonder.
Yeah, it does make you wonder. I mean, Ohio, Pennsylvania, as we said, that's kind of where you get a lot of those really strange reports that link the UFOs and the Bigfoot activity. So.
Oh, I know something I wanted to ask you about. I didn't even have it in my keywords, but it just kind of shined into my brain. What's your take on all the David Pilates stuff, missing 411 and all these people missing in the wilderness and stuff? What's your take on that? What do you think's happening?
Well, this admission is probably going to sound rather odd since I just started in a TV show called Missing in Alaska, which essentially was based on missing people cases and how they might relate to strange phenomenon. Of course, I'm familiar with David Pilates' research. I've never read any of his books. You know, I've picked up little bits and pieces here, and I know many people that have read them and kind of filled me in here and there. But and it's not out of disrespect to him or his research, because I understand he's a very thorough researcher and spends a lot of time doing that. But I've got, as you guys can imagine, books and books and books that are coming in daily and stacking up on my desk here, and it's just like not enough time in the day. But you know, I'll say this, and this is going to be more of my experience doing the show in Alaska, because we investigated a lot of different avenues for these missing people cases. We looked at UFO abduction is one possibility. We looked at Bigfoot or Sasquatch abduction of humans is one possibility. We looked at vortexes. We looked at other strange creatures. We looked at some government, you know, conspiracies and things like that. There was even an episode that we wanted to shoot about satanic cult in Alaska, and the History Channel kind of chickened out at the last minute, guys, but this is an interesting story. I don't know if you're familiar with this or not, but there is apparently a lot of satanic cult activity in Alaska, particularly in and around the town of Nome, and I thought that would have been a really cool angle to investigate, but very creepy stuff, but they kind of chickened out, so we didn't get to do that one. But anyways, after investigating all those different cases, I think that you really have to acknowledge that in national parks, which is what David Pilates writes about mostly, I think, and most of the areas we investigated, there are so many ways to vanish and disappear that are not necessarily metaphysical. For example, I fractured my ankle during filming one episode and had to be lifted down off of a mountain, and there was a huge rescue effort, and if I had been by myself, I was a goner. You know, I would have perished there and on that mountainside, and no one would have ever known it. You know, you're in these remote areas, and you know, a lot of times you don't have cell phone reception, you don't have access to help, to resources. So you have things like hypothermia, you have people falling and hurting themselves, or you have a lot of people that want to disappear. You know, that's kind of a strange thing, but wrap your head around that. But one of my team members on Missing Alaska is Jax Atwell, who is a private investigator, and he strongly believed and stated that many of the missing person cases, that people do want to disappear. You know, there are people that just simply become overwhelmed by life, and they wander off into the wilderness, and, you know, so you've got a lot of factors there. But I certainly think that, you know, stepping back, I know I'm kind of babbling here, but the UFO abduction phenomenon has obviously been well documented for a number of years. That is a possibility. I mean, when you're talking about Alaska has a lot of UFO sightings, you're talking about a very remote area where the population density is very low. So theoretically, if you have UFOs flying around, that's a place where they wouldn't be seen as often. And then you also have a lot of accounts of Bigfoot or Sasquatch kidnapping and abducting people. The most famous one is the Albert Ostman story from the 1920s. Guy claimed he was kidnapped by a family of Sasquatches. There was also a guy named Mushalot Harry, a Native American man, that claimed the same thing. Grandma Charlie, you know. So these stories do pop up of people being abducted by Sasquatches and then ultimately escaping or being released. What if some people don't escape or aren't released? It's possible.
Definitely, for sure. The first case you mentioned, is that the guy in the cave where he went there and there was like a family and he did something and distracted them and ran off or something?
Yeah, you're close. This guy was alone. He was a prospector in 1924. He was up in British Columbia looking for a gold mine. And one night something picked him up, and it was a Sasquatch. According to him, it carried him miles back to its little lair, and he lived with this family of Sasquatches for several days because they had him pinned in this valley. It wasn't a cave. It was a valley that he couldn't get out of. And ultimately, he tricked the big male Sasquatch into eating some of his chewing tobacco, which caused, according to him, caused the Sasquatch to get violently ill, and he used that as a distraction or diversion to make his escape.
Wow.
can't do the tobacco. That's funny.
So who was a Native American one? There's a Native American guy on Missing in Alaska with you. Who was he?
Oh, yeah, that's Tommy Joseph. Tommy he's Tlingit, which if you look at Alaska, there are only a few groups of Native Americans there. The Tlingits live, you have the Kwakiutl and the Tlingits there on kind of the peninsula there. Far southeast Alaska in the rainforest. And then you go, as you go north from there, then you get into like the Athabascans, the Yupik, the Inuit people. But Tommy is Tlingit, and he's grown up with many of the legends of Alaska. He's a very famous artist. He does totem poles that are all over the world in different cities, Moscow and New Zealand. And he's kind of a rock star in Alaska. Wherever we travel with him, you know, people would, oh, you're Tommy Joseph, the totem pole guy. So we had little jokes about that, about how he was kind of the Alaskan rock star. But the kind of the tragedy as far as Tommy's concerned, is that his father is actually a missing person. When he was a young boy, his father went out on a fishing trip by himself in a canoe and never returned. So he had kind of a, he was the kind of the impetus or the starting point for the show. And then they brought in the private investigator and myself to kind of fill out the team. But he was on a personal mission to kind of, you know, find some closure, some validation. And we were hopeful that by maybe investigating some of these missing persons cases that we could obtain some of that. So, very touching story, though.
Wasn't there an episode? Yeah, missing cases and stuff, and like the missing 411 books and stuff. Like, I already have enough weird problems where I don't want to leave my house. Like, I'm in Florida right now, and the whole Zika thing's going on, and they're about to napalm us from the sky to stop it.
Yeah.
So that makes me not want to go outside because you get bit by them or get God knows what from, you know, insecticide. They haven't got, I'm up in the top of the panhandle, but right now they're firebombing Miami. So trying to stop it. But as far as, you had an episode about a bear god or something, wasn't that one of the titles?
Yeah.
What was that about?
Yeah, the Torngasuk. The Torngasuk is an Inuit legend, and I should point out that Inuit people, commonly referred to as Eskimos, and by the way, they consider that a derogatory term. They don't like to be called Eskimos. They like to be called Inuits. The Inuit people stretch from Alaska all the way across northern Canada and even into, like, Greenland and places like that. And there's a legend in Inuit mythology about the Torngasuk, which is basically a bear god, either a giant bear or a bear-like deity that is associated with fishing and, you know, certain other aspects of their culture. And so we had investigated this. There was a village that had been abandoned on this island, Hinchinbrook, which is an island where some of the largest bears in the world, the grizzlies, you know, you have giant world record grizzlies that are like 1,200 pounds, not quite as big as the Kodiaks, but really, really huge brown bears. And the people in this village had reported, some people had reported allegedly a bear that was very strange. Some people said it was white, not a polar bear, but maybe. I mean, that was something that was, you know, polar bears aren't native to that part of Alaska, but a large white bear and a mystery bear. And so we looked at it from different angles, whether in fact it could be just an exceptional specimen of bear that had scared these people out of this village, or maybe there was something more metaphysical in nature. Maybe this was some type of manifestation or energy form that appeared as a bear or bear-like in form.
So have you come across, like, medicine men or anything from some of your adventures with natives and stuff?
No, honestly, I have to say, not really. I mean, I've met and talked to Native American people and people in indigenous cultures in other third world countries, but no one that I would consider an actual shaman or a medicine man. That would be a David Weatherly question for sure, because he's done a bunch of that stuff. It's pretty fascinating.
I've written and interviewed him before, but I need to get him on the show. I've tried to get him, but he's busy, very busy, but I'll nab him one day.
He's a busy guy, but he's got some really, really creepy stories.
Yeah, I'm going to have to ask him about that Skinwalker stuff for sure. I've interviewed J.C. Johnson about Skinwalker stuff.
Oh, yeah.
That stuff gets pretty freaky. He was telling how you become a Skinwalker from the Native legends and all that. That's some creepy stuff. But what I was saying about the missing 411 stuff, those stories, it's probably good you haven't read them. They're interesting, but reading one after another, I mean, it's horrific. It makes me, like, I have woods all around me, and I walk the trails, but after reading those, I freak out thinking about it.
Yeah. Maybe that's the, maybe subconsciously that's a reason I've avoided them, because I spend so much time in the wilderness, and I don't want to read anything that would deter me from going out there, you know.
They're pretty terrifying. It's like a 1,001 ways to die in the wilderness.
Wow.
All these grotesque cases, for sure. But we got about 30 minutes. Wham, you got anything in your Joker sleeve?
My Joker sleeve. Well, the next question that I was going to ask, Ken, or we're not going to take a break, right? We're just going to go straight through. Right. Okay. Are you supposed to do the call signs?
Oh yeah, you're listening to United Public Radio 107.7 FM, New Orleans.
Rockin'. Okay. Now the question I was going to ask, Ken, is it sounds to me like you have a lot of fun doing this. So, and even though some of the stories are kind of creepy and you're probably in some interesting situations, what is the thing that you get the most out of studying or researching this material?
Oh, wow. Well, first of all, thanks for the nice compliment. Yes, I do have fun. I think I'm a big kid at heart. I've never lost that sense of wonder that I had the very first time I heard about Bigfoot when I was 8 years old. And ever since that, I've kind of had that desire to explore and to seek out some of these strange mysteries. It's hard for me to pinpoint my favorite, it really is, but I think one thing that I'm obviously known for within the field are flying cryptids, and specifically thunderbirds, which are, you know, relates to the Native American legends of these giant birds that are often depicted on totem poles and different places. And there are a number of modern sightings of these giant birds. And when I say big, I mean like big, like 15 to 25 foot wingspans are what people describe. So, you know, easily four times bigger than the biggest eagles or vultures. So I find those kind of fascinating. Very passionate about that subject because it's been neglected by other researchers, and there's really nobody that's kind of leading the charge in that particular aspect. Bigfoot or Sasquatch, lifelong interest and passion. There are a heck of a lot of outstanding Bigfoot and Sasquatch researchers in the field. I've had the great honor and pleasure of meeting many of them, and it's I think we're in good hands there. I think there are a lot of people out there in the field that are looking at it very scientifically, objectively, very passionate people that are working very hard. And so that I'm involved in that as well. But, you know, I feel like there are a lot of people that are already doing that. So I kind of the flying cryptids like thunderbirds and things like that, the living pterodactyls, the flying humanoids, Mothman, and so forth. Things with wings. That's what really
things
pushes my butt.
Wings.
Things
with
that's wings.
That's nice. That's nice. The reason that's nice because I agree. I think that those are not really looked at very much. I periodically do a presentation here. I live up in the Mid-Hudson Valley of New York, and I do a presentation on the relationship between the native traditions here. Which interestingly enough, a lot of people don't really know that much about, you know, here right in this area in the Hudson Valley, and various cryptid creatures, you know, looking at the relationship between what natives have reported, what they used to report, what they occasionally still report now in this area, and how that may bear relationship to what other people are experiencing. And one of the things that is reported, at least more to the north, as you go towards Albany and up into the Adirondacks, is a large bird-type being. And it's huge, the pictures that I've seen that natives have drawn of it. It looks sort of like a condor,
mm-hmm.
I guess, if you were to look at the configuration of it. But the wingspan tip to tip has got to be 20 or 30 feet. It's
wow.
It's really large, and I've actually gotten reports of it as natives seeing it as recently as just a few months ago. Some accounts. So I know that they are still reporting it. For them, it's a religious. It has religious significance. And they relate it to beings that protect them from the horned serpents, which are considered to be,
heard of those. Mm-hmm.
You've heard of those, yes. And of course, they're not really considered to be evil, like, you know, Westerners would consider them to be evil, but they're not good for humans, essentially, because they like to, you know, according to the Haudenosaunee, they like to, and the Lenape, they like to capture people and take them away. They get enamored with our beauty or something, and they like to take us away and marry us or something, and we get trapped in, under the waves of Lake Ontario, you know. So the big birds are related to like thunder beings.
Mm-hmm.
They help to protect them. So if they see them, then they see this as and they interpret this as that they're being protected from some danger. So
yeah, is it interesting? I'm sorry, you're making some great points, but the word monstrum in Latin means warning. And it's so interesting that as you explore these different legends around the world, whether it's Bigfoot or sea serpents or thunderbirds, to see those is often kind of interpreted or construed as an omen, isn't it? As a harbinger of some horrible event that something bad is going to happen to you. So
that you have to pay attention. Yeah. Yeah, it is interesting. I agree. I mean, I know that John Keel kind of speculated about that a little bit, and it's you know, I don't really, I have not had any, I've only had maybe one possible cryptid experience, you know, obvious cryptid experience. And I can't even say that for sure. It was just something that was odd. So when I come at cryptids, that's something that, you know, I'm really used to UFO stuff and I'm really used to ghost
sure.
stuff. But I'm not so accustomed, you know, to Bigfoot stuff or to these to seeing large critters. I have had some odd experiences in the woods, but I haven't seen anything. You know, I don't actually see things like that. So. But these stories of the large birds have fascinated me. So I've just been collecting them. I've just been sort of taking note of them.
I'd love to hear more if you can, maybe through Jeffrey, shoot me some information. Point out that north central Pennsylvania, the Black Mountains and the Susquehanna
right.
River Valley, is traditionally one of the real hot spots for thunderbird sightings going back to the 1800s. And they still get a lot of reports out of that area.
Yeah, I do have this one in the presentation that I do. I have a photograph that was taken by a guy that's from that area that supposedly shows a large bird rising. It's just at the. It's not real clear, but it's just taking off from the ground, and so you can kind of see the curve of it, of a wing. It's hard to get the scale on it. But he was saying that as it rose up, it was far larger than any eagle or vulture that he had ever seen.
Wow.
So that's, you know, I've seen that, and that's from that area. I don't know that any of the natives that I've spoken to have taken any photos because they don't really do that. You know what I mean? It's,
sure.
There are some pretty good stories that I've been hearing. So I'll try to collect a couple and send them your way.
That would be cool. I would appreciate that. It's very frustrating with regard to the alleged Thunderbird photos. Just quickly, because, I mean, this could go off on a whole other tangent, which I don't want to go on necessarily. But there's a famous Thunderbird photo that I'm sure everyone has heard of that supposedly in Arizona in the late 1800s or 1900s. Photo of this giant Thunderbird stretched out. No one can actually, John Keel claims that he'd seen it, other people. No one can produce a copy of it. Then you have, just recently I've been contacted by a gentleman in Texas who told me that he knew a gentleman from Mexico who had photographed a Thunderbird. But lo and behold, when it was time to hunt down the photograph, the guy had gone back to Mexico and vanished mysteriously. Then I was contacted by a lady from Canada who worked near a Native American reservation and said that there were some Thunderbird photos that, and of course when I did try to track those down, and there was some inexplicable explanation. And then just recently a guy told me he had pictures of a Thunderbird that he had taken in Canada on an old hard drive, but now he's unable to retrieve the photos from the hard drive for this reason and that reason. So it's like, you know, it's frustrating, but it seems like there are many claims or allegations out there of Thunderbirds on film, but I've never been able to get my hands on one.
Right. Yeah. I mean, none of the natives who've talked to me have even offered any photos. So, you know, that's not something I really, you know, I do a lot of work with natives in this area, so I don't really ask them things like that, you know, because
right,
the work
sure.
that I'm doing with them isn't really sort of, you know, to mine them for information about, you know, that kind of stuff. But, obviously, if something comes up, I will let you know. So I'm not really looking for that, but I'll put together a couple of two or three accounts and shoot them your way.
Oh, that would be awesome. I appreciate that.
Sure.
I know one thing I wanted to ask. We got about 20 minutes. What about these massive amphibians? What's the deal with that? Is that like giant frogs, the Loveland frog? I mean, what kind of different cases are you seeing there?
Yeah, I'm glad you asked me about that, Jeffrey. Well done, because that's one that people kind of gloss over. But giant amphibians. Okay, so for example, there's a section about the Loch Ness Monster that I kind of speculate about. There has been a theory around for a long time, and I'm not the first one to think of it, but that the Loch Ness Monster, if it exists, could be some type of giant monstrous amphibian. So there's been a common... You know, the imagery of the Loch Ness Monster, of course, that we all have in our minds is this dinosaur-like creature, the plesiosaur, with the long neck and the tiny head. Well, the problem is that plesiosaurs were reptiles, were air breathers, and also because they were cold-blooded, we're assuming they're cold-blooded, they probably couldn't live in a cold lake like Loch Ness. So the plesiosaur theory, even though that's kind of the enduring image, doesn't make sense. But what if the Loch Ness Monster were some type of giant amphibian, like a giant salamander? There have been, in the past, there were, for example, in the Devonian period, there were amphibians that were 15 feet, 20 feet long, maybe even longer. Amphibians, unlike reptiles, can adapt to colder water temperatures, case in point being the giant Japanese and giant Chinese salamanders, which prefer kind of cold, frigid streams. And the last and most important aspect is that amphibians are able to breathe cutaneously through their skin. So they can actually do the exchange of gases and oxygen and carbon dioxide through their skin. So they don't have to come to the surface to breathe oxygen. So you could theoretically have these giant amphibians that live in the deep down in Loch Ness that don't come to the surface very often, and maybe that's why they're not seen. So that was one thing I went into. One of the other stories was the Loveland frog. And because the Loveland frog has been in the news lately, this is kind of very current and timely thing to talk about. So many of your listeners have probably heard of the Loveland frog, which is described as like an amphibious humanoid creature about 3 feet tall that was seen and shot at by two police officers in Loveland, Ohio back in 1972. Just recently, there was a person who claimed that they were out playing Pokemon Go and that they captured a picture of the Loveland frog by accident. So that appeared online and went viral. And then one of the police officers who's been associated with this story for years and years came forward and said that whole story was a hoax. What we actually saw and shot was an iguana that had escaped from somewhere that was about 3 feet long and was missing its tail. And this thing was very sickly and half dead, but we saw this iguana run across the road and we shot it. It didn't go up on its hind legs. So, you know, basically a lot of people have accepted it. Okay, that makes sense. There's an escaped iguana. That's weird, but it's not as weird as a monster, so that's what it is. Well, guess what? I did some research, and I found out that, according to the Farmer's Almanac, the temperature in Loveland, Ohio that night was 33 degrees Fahrenheit, 1 degree above freezing. There is no way that an iguana, which is a tropical cold-blooded reptile, is going to be running across a road in freezing temperatures. It's impossible. They would be burrowed down somewhere. They'd probably be dead or half dead. So that doesn't make sense. And then the fact that he said that this thing was missing a tail, that seems kind of rather like an odd detail and something that you wouldn't expect to see. And this may relate to the original drawings of the Loveland frog, which showed it as a tailless, bipedal frog-like animal. And the last and the most condemning thing is that the first officer that saw this thing cross the road had his sister do a forensic sketch of what he saw. And that is the classic image of the Loveland frog that we've all seen. Something walking on its hind legs, frog-like and humanoid-like and whatever. So if what he saw was an iguana, that doesn't make any sense that illustration shows this hulking, bipedal, amphibious creature. So basically what I'm trying to say here, and I'm not in the habit of attacking anybody's character, but what I think is that this gentleman is, who's obviously older now, is essentially tired of the Loveland Frog story, tired of being associated with this Loveland Frog story, tired of being associated with this weirdness in his life, and has basically come up with this whole concocted story about this iguana to basically put the whole thing to rest so that no one will harass him anymore. Does that make sense? I mean, that's my theory.
Makes sense to me.
I mean, I'm just saying, it's, his story doesn't make a lot more sense than an amphibious frog-like creature, but the Loveland Frog is one of those creatures that definitely belongs in Kiel's Goblin universe. There haven't been a lot of sightings. It doesn't make any sense from a zoological point of view. But anyways, that's the sense I get, is that this guy is basically trying to put the whole story to rest and creating this iguana story. I could be wrong, and again, I don't want to come across that I'm attacking this guy's character. I think he has a valid reason for making up this story if his point is to basically detach himself from the whole phenomenon.
I'll have to look up the Pokemon Frogman thing. I didn't see that. Is that pretty much fake, or did you see the photo of that?
You know, who can tell these days, Jeffrey? I mean, with Photoshop and all these things, it's like, yeah, it looks like kind of a frog-like thing with glowing eyes standing on its hind legs, but, you know, someone could have easily put something like that together. So, but it is cool. You should check it out. Go online and look up Loveland Frog, and it's probably going to be some of the more recent posts that will come up.
Even if something's real nowadays, even if it was absolutely real, so many people wouldn't believe it that it was, or nobody would.
Yeah.
Yeah, it'd be hard unless you were like it was right in front of you.
I wanted to tell this story real quick, but I just remembered it. Last night I was posting articles where I work at, and that video leaked of on the CERN grounds in Switzerland. All these people in cloaks gathered around this girl, and then a knife comes out, and they stab her to death. It didn't really show them stabbing her, but you knew she was dead on the ground. And, of course, I saw it, and I was like, this looks like bunk, but it's weird because it's out on the CERN grounds. It's bizarro. You know, it's there, and it's like there's the statue of Shiva and all that stuff. Well, I posted it, and it's going on about 10,000 clicks in a day. But anyway,
wow.
CERN released a statement saying it was summer vacationers pulling a prank. which maybe they're lying, but I'm pretty sure it was vacationers, but it was still weird that it was just there in front of CERN.
That's
kind
crazy.
Of a strange prank, actually.
It was really weird. Like, it went viral last night. But, so I know you talk about portals and stuff and missing Alaska and stuff. What are your thoughts on all that stuff? All these, you know, multidimensional portals and stuff like that.
Oh, Jeffrey, I don't think I'm smart enough to eloquently describe my thoughts on that. I mean, obviously, you know, the field of quantum physics, which is kind of a cutting edge, you know, Einstein was the first one to suggest, you know, the string theory, that we have this intricate fabric of time and space, and, you know, you could have things going up on the, you know, the molecular level in terms of, you know, antimatter and different things. I mean, it's kind of mind-warping to even try to consider that, but sure, why could there not be parallel dimensions of time and space, and if so, why would it not be possible that occasionally there are sort of tears or window areas where things can move back and forth from one continuum to another? I mean, it seems, even for someone like me that doesn't really understand quantum physics, it seems like a possibility when you consider the infinite nature of our universe and just the vast majority of it we just don't understand yet, you know. But we did find some interesting electromagnetic anomalies in relation to the vortex that we investigated, and that makes sense too, I suppose, because electromagnetic energy, of course, courses through everything on the planet, the core of our Earth. It courses through all living things. We all have a certain minute degree of electromagnetic energy within ourselves, and so there is probably, if a vortex can open and close, then it probably has to do with some type of magnetic pulse or energy or buildup of magnetic energy, and then, you know, maybe that's what triggers it. Who knows?
Definitely. One of my big eye-openers was right after my dad died, I saw a person made out of light in the cloud tops with a friend, just like standing there. And a few years back, I saw two fly out of my roof into the heavens here in Florida. And to me, that was all the proof I needed. Believe it. And then, of course, I think that that's what we are. Like, we're like weird energy beings of some sort. And that was pretty much my big, you know, one of many awakeners that all these realms are around us. And, you know, obviously if you believe some part of you carries on into the next world when you pass away, then that part of you
sure.
has been somewhere before this and came from somewhere, probably where you're going back to when you croak. So
makes sense, yeah.
But that was my opener, just seeing something like that, definitely. There's a good movie, the Midnight Special, that came out, that has Michael Shannon in it, and it's about this little boy that's an alien, and there's all these multidimensional realms around, and then he meets with them, and they're beings of light. That just came out recently. That I was like, wow, this is like my philosophy in a movie.
Very cool.
Yeah, definitely. So, what are you working on? Is there anything you can talk about that you're working on book-wise in the future, or anything else?
Well, in 3 weeks, I will be, on Labor Day weekend, I will be lecturing and appearing at the International Bigfoot Conference up in Kennewick, Washington. It's going to be a huge event. They're expecting like over 1,000 people. And you basically have all the legends of the Bigfoot field, Bob Gimlin, Jeff Meldrum, John Bindernagel, Lauren Coleman, Adam Davies, Cliff Barrickman. So, I mean, it's, and I'll be up there as well. So that's going to be, I'm really excited to be up there in 3 weeks. So anybody who's passionate about Bigfoot or Sasquatch, I would encourage you to look into the International Bigfoot Conference. And then I'm also going to be appearing at the Mothman Festival in Point Pleasant on September 17th. And this is the 50th anniversary of the famous Mothman Scarberry Mallet sightings and some of the original sightings of the Mothman. So that should be a pretty fantastic event. Other than that, not too much going on, just kind of planning out, you know, whether there is a possible TV show in the future or maybe a book or something like that. So we'll see how it goes.
Okay, we got about 7 minutes. What were some of the Monster Quest episodes that you were in? What were they pertaining to as far as subject matter?
Well, the first episode I was in was about Thunderbirds. That was from season one. It was called Birdzilla. And I was in it briefly, but it covered, just like we were talking about a little while ago, the giant Native American Thunderbirds that have been reported throughout Pennsylvania, Illinois, and elsewhere. Season two, I did the episode on the Chupacabra. And in this case, it was the Texas version of the Chupacabra. And then season three, I did a flying humanoids episode where I traveled down to Mexico. It was called Terror from the Sky, and we investigated Mothman-type beings in Mexico.
Nice.
And those were the only three episodes. I was actually asked to appear on both the Jersey Devil and Mothman episodes as well, but I had conflicts in my schedule at that time, and I wasn't able to do that.
Well, I definitely hope you get some kind of, if not a season two of Missing Alaska, you resurrect something else TV show-wise, because we need more of the unique personality that Missing Alaska was showing with all the strange titles and stuff. So a lot of stuff's just cut and dry now, or really boring, or over-dramatized, or just so ridiculous. Like, there's some stuff on Destination America. Like, there's some good stuff on there, but there's some I can't even fathom how stupid it is. I can't even watch it. Like that mountain monsters and stuff. I just, you know, there's going on with that at all. Come on, somebody's steak in a cage tonight. Waited out of wood.
Yeah, far be it for me to judge. I don't certainly don't watch any of those shows, but I can say that I've been investigating cryptids for at least 20 years now, and I've never seen one with my own eyes, and yet there are guys out there that manage to see them on a weekly basis. So that's all I need to say about that.
They build these traps, and I don't recall them ever catching it and showing it to us.
Yeah, that's true. It's always kind of, well, like I said, I don't watch them. But, you know, it's I suppose there are a lot of people that are entertained by those shows, so.
Ridiculous. Some of them are good on there, but that one I'm not a fan of.
It's a balancing act when you do a television show, because ultimately you want to get the best information out there, and you want to do it as scientific, and you want to represent the paranormal and cryptozoology in the best possible light. But on the other hand, you have a network that's paying millions of dollars to produce the show, and then you have a production company that's kind of the in between, and there's some give and take, because sometimes they want, as has often been stated to me, nobody's going to watch a show where nothing happens, which, as you guys know, a lot of times during an investigation, nothing happens. So, but I would never be involved in a show that fabricated anything. But on the other hand, sometimes you overreact, you know, which is a natural tendency anyways. You're walking through the woods at night and you hear something move and you're like, holy crap, what is that? And then, you know, they cut to a commercial, and when they come back, you've realized that it was a rabbit, and you're going, oh, you feel kind of silly, and you go, oh, man, it was just that rabbit just startled me, you know. But I think it's okay for TV producers to kind of do that, you know, because they have to essentially add that entertainment aspect. But on the other hand, as far as fabricating things, I think that's a huge no-no, and obviously it reflects very poorly on the field when they do that kind of stuff.
Definitely. Well, we're going to go ahead and close out. Do you have a website or anything?
Yes, I have a website. It's kengerhard.com, KENGERHARD.com. I also have a Facebook page for my fans. It's Ken Gerhard, Cryptozoologist. At this time, I do not have a Twitter account, and I'm still resisting that because I've just got so much going on already, and I don't think I can keep up with that. So, Facebook, or go to my website if anyone wants to get in touch. Check me out.
All right, Ken. We appreciate it. Thanks for coming on again. We really enjoyed it. Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Thank you, guys. Great, engaging conversation as always, and we'll have to do it again sometime.
For sure. All right. Take care, man.
Be well.
All right. Take care. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. All right, everybody. You're listening to United Public Radio, 107.7 FM New Orleans. We're cutting down now and ending the show. We're doing an hour and a half. I've been a little under the weather, and Ken was a little under the weather, but we really wanted to do the show, so we kept on trucking so we could bring you amphibians and lycanthropes and all sorts of other menagerie of beasts. So thanks, Wham, and we'll see you all next Friday. Good night, and have a good weekend.
From the beautiful mountains of Western North Carolina, just outside the Blue Ridge Parkway, under the stars and around our mysterious blue planet, you are listening to Shadows in the Dark.
Shadows in the Dark.
I hope everyone's having a good week. We are here in beautiful Western North Carolina. It's been a beautiful week, good weather, although we could use a little rain, which I think we could most anywhere. Well, I want to kind of tell everybody how to get to the archives, because Blog Talk's changed the site around, so it's a little different than what it was before. We mentioned this a couple shows back, so I just want to kind of go back over it again just to make sure everybody understands. Once you go to the site and you go to our host page, which is blogtalkradio.com/shadowsinthedark, you'll see our logo over there, and right below it you'll see a few little options, and one of them says subscribe via RSS. And what you're going to do is you're going to click on that, and if you choose to subscribe to it, you don't even have to visit the host page to listen to the archives. You could just go straight off of it, and if you've got Internet Explorer 7, then it may It saves it right in there, another browser that automatically keeps your RSS or your XML feed. So that's how you can listen to the archives. And I'm looking at